I get that. Yeah, yeah. That I think you're right. That's where we are, and this part of the chapter, Sri Aurobindo, after having introduced the more logical progression in what is entailed in what he calls the triple transformation, that is successive steps of developing psychic transformation over and through cosmic spiritual transformation, and then going beyond that into the supernatural and bringing its power to transform the nature. In this section, he is complicating that sequence. And essentially, he's saying all this sounds very neat, but in fact, it's not so. Nature does not move in such a sort of clear succession of steps. And first he puts it generally by talking about how with cosmic nature itself, there are experiments going on all the time where certain new things which seem like freaks are, experienced or, manifest. And then takes a good amount of time for that power to be assimilated and become more general. So that kind of feature is something which is common to human history and actually to the whole march of nature. From there, he takes off and talks about three problems which complicate this natural succession idea that he had introduced. The first one has to do with the ascent, and that is in that as we open ourselves to higher powers of consciousness, we find that there are partial eruptions, if one may use that term, of something even higher that starts working before whatever we have started on is complete. That is, so to say, if there is an attempt to perfect something of the psychic, the spiritual action may begin just by dint of the pressure put by the sadhana. If the higher mind opening takes place, certain inner silence occupies the mind, something of a higher mind or even higher intuitive mind or beyond that may start acting through the inner mind silence without actually having gone through the successive stages of whatever is beyond the mind. We see this, for example, in his own discussions of the future poetry. And we see this also in the remarks he makes to people who attempted to write poetry, while he was alive, where certain rare articulations of a very high order seem to come through, even in cases where not sufficient understanding of the lower levels of the process is even there. So this may happen, but the point he makes there is that this help from something higher has to be allowed to stabilize, and there is no escape from the the integrated succession of steps in the higher consciousness. So that pertains to the ascent, one may say. Then the second problem pertains to the descent or the transforming force. That is, as he says, whatever has been touched above has to be brought into the nature and the nature made to express it in a coherent fashion. Now, that has serious difficulty because, as he points out, that whatever comes into some power of the ignorance is challenged by densities of ignorance that have already compromised these other levels. The mind has already, created a pact with lower forms of consciousness in the ignorance, with the vital, with the subconscious, with the inconscious, with various degrees of ignorance to which it is attached. And even if the inner mind escapes from these particular pacts, we may say, there is still the work to be done, which cannot be fully done until the light above goes further to the lower levels and transforms them. By the way, I think Keka is now online and would like to join. So as he says that really the no part of the work can be said to be really done until all of it is done. This is even with regard to the descent. So we proceed piecemeal, but we are constantly ambushed by that which is not yet finished until something even more fundamental or radical is achieved. Then the third difficulty he brings up is that which has to do with the lateral movement, the inner and outer consciousness. That is, again, all these things may be proceeding in the inner consciousness of the individual, but we are related to the external through a circumconscient. And our environing consciousness is constantly sending us a variety of forms of conscious response or unconscious response, which are coming into contact with the inner process that is going on in each of us. And how are we to arrive at a point where we are fully cognizant of everything that is coming in and going out of us, and everything bears the purity and power of a higher consciousness? That difficulty is something that again requires a gradual growth into universality, which is not just a universality of being, but a universality of nature, the power over universal nature. And there too, we stop short at what he has introduced earlier, which is that universal nature itself is built on this over-mental ignorance, that the foundation of the cosmic ignorance is what faces us all around in the responses that come to us from outside. So how are we to deal with it? This becomes a real question. And that's, I think, where we are right now. He's talking of the third complexity.
So, Devashishna, could you also talk about another complexity that I find is that many of the times there isn't constant feedback, right? So the outer being is many times unaware of what has happened or what is happening. So could you speak to that a bit?
Yes, indeed. In fact, this is certainly, particularly in the earlier parts of the process, this is a big problem, because things take place, as Sri Aurobindo says, behind the veil. And that's because we are pushed into an external consciousness which is largely unconscious. And even if we have moments of lucidity or rise to some higher consciousness, when that comes down into the lower parts of the consciousness, it seems to have disappeared. And that disappearance can be extremely painful. In fact, that is one aspect, as we said, we were discussing this earlier, of one way of talking about the dark night of the soul. So there are these periods that can be kind of, you know, absences of light or absences of God, but they develops a certain faith, which is like the, you know, sort of single lamp, clean lamp that is lit in the home, even when, you know, night seems to rain. There develops a certain degree of presence of the psychic flame in the outer nature, which is the safeguard through these particular periods. Afterwards, there is a sense, a kind of intuitive sense of the working that is going on all the time. And even when it is not overt, that can be, you know, the saving factor.
Yeah, thank you, Devash. Sitaram, would you like to start reading?
The third complexity is brought in by the power of consciousness to live in more than one status at a time. Especially, a difficulty is created by the division of our being into an inner and an outer or surface nature, and the farther intricacy of a secret circumconscient or environmental consciousness in which are determined our unseen connections with the world outside us. In the spiritual opening, it is the awakened inner being that readily receives and assimilates the higher influences and puts on the higher nature. The external surface self, more entirely molded by the forces of ignorance and inconscience, is slower to awake, slower to receive, slower to assimilate. There is, therefore, a long stage in which the inner being is sufficiently transformed, but the outer is still involved in a mixed and difficult movement of imperfect change. This disparity repeats itself at each step of the ascent, for in each change, the inner being follows more readily the outer limbs after, reluctant or else incompetent in spite of its aspiration and desire. This necessitates a constantly repeated labor of assumption, adoption, orientation, a labor reproduced in new terms always, but always the same in principle. But even when the outer and the inner nature of the individual are unified in a harmonized spiritual consciousness, that still more external but occult part of him in which his being mixes with the being of the outside world and through which the outside world invades his consciousness remains a field of imperfection. There is necessarily a commerce here between the disparate influences. The inner spiritual influence is met by quite opposite influences, strong in their control of the present world order. The new spiritual consciousness has to bear the shock of the dominant and established unspiritualized powers of the ignorance. This creates a difficulty which is of capital importance in all stages of spiritual evolution and its urge towards a change of the nature. This is exactly what you just said, Shyam.
Yeah, and also, you see, this is the state where one comes face to face with the fact that the environment it makes a difference to, you know, the growth of the consciousness. Now, for a long time, though, this may not be the case. This, what he's talking about over here, is also to be taken in stages, in that individual consciousness and its growth in the inner being can proceed quite far and needs to proceed quite far, developing its immunity from the outside till a certain point comes when even the most external part of nature needs to subject itself to the highest transformation. Now, we may think about two particular major decisions taken by Sri Aurobindo and the mother, which pertain to this thing that we are reading right now. One of them is the decision to found an ashram in the first place. The mother talks about this. She says that for a long time, they were wondering whether the better way to do this entire yoga would be for Sri Aurobindo and the mother to proceed in a very intense manner in their own spiritual growth. And, you know, only maybe after a very high realization had been stabilized in them to interact with the outside world. And then the other option was to create an environment in which different degrees of progress would be coexisting with their own, so that, you know, it was almost like a kind of a collective movement that was initiated. And the mother says that it wasn't in fact that they had to decide, but the second kind of movement was what emerged by the fiat of the higher force. The other major sort of decision related to this, I believe, has to do with Sri Aurobindo's own decision to withdraw after the overmental transformation of 1926. You know, Sri Aurobindo withdrew. The question is, what does that mean, particularly since his yoga is supposed to be a yoga which deals with the world? The two ways of understanding that. One is that the intensity of need to achieve the third stage of the transformation, the supramental transformation, necessitated a one-pointed effort in that direction. But the other aspect to that also is exactly what he's talking about here. Not that he couldn't neutralize or change the powers that, as he says, invade from the outside, but that it would involve a tremendous expenditure of energy, which he needed to give in an unstinted way towards that last effort that he was putting into the third stage of the transformation. However, he did continue to open himself to the environment, environing force through a variety of ways, letter writing, the darshan, and particularly through the action of the mother, who even more strongly went out into the middle of the activities of the collective and exchanged her consciousness with those who were around. So I think that double action, action on the world and growth within, is something that is a constant testing of the water and transforming of the sort of circumconscient that needs to continue along with the inner growth.
So, Debashisda, I'm not sure if I understood this correctly, but were you saying that with reference to this paragraph, how he's talking about the inner and the outer being progressing at different paces, and the outer being, you know, being either not so invested or even if invested, incompetent? So, were you saying that in the same way, Sri Aurobindo himself felt that the outer being got if it got involved as before, and that's why he decided to withdraw within. Is that what was the message?
No, not exactly, Sham. What I'm saying is, what you just said is part of what he's saying in this paragraph. There are two difficulties here. One difficulty is that the individual external nature is, as you said, made up of a much tardier substance, made up of this more inconscient material, and that needs to be, sort of brought under the light and transformed, the wall broken down, as it were. I don't think that was the problem that caused Sri Aurobindo to withdraw. But there's a second problem with that, and that's what he's saying, that even when, see, let me read you that part. He actually puts it exactly like that. He said, but even when the outer and inner nature of the individual are united in a harmonized spiritual consciousness, that still more external and occult part of him, in which his being mixes with the being of the outside world, and outside world invades his consciousness, remains the field of imperfection. So here there is individual consciousness has changed, but a certain degree of that more fluid in-between space of consciousness, where the individual merges into the universal, is a difficult thing because it is really partaking of the nature of the universal. There is necessarily a commerce here between disparate influences. The inner spiritual influence is met by quite opposite influences, strong in their control of the present world order. So the present world order itself is controlled by these forces of ignorance and falsehood, as he puts out somewhere. Now, one may have control over these, but to subject oneself to them would require an inner decision to expend a lot of energy on an ongoing basis, which may be required for something else. And that is exactly, I believe, what happened in his own case. While in the mother's case, she was doing exactly that, expending that energy in transforming those forces of that circumconscient that allowed the universal ignorance to be transformed, or to be in a process of transformation.
Debashish, he uses the terms external and occult, and I've always thought of those as opposites. Occult is hidden, and something that is external, I would think, is visible. So can you explain how external and occult fit together?
Yeah. Yes, you're quite right in that sense that Sri Aurobindo himself uses the term occult consciousness for what he sometimes calls the inner being or the subliminal consciousness. But here what he's talking about is a hidden part of the external nature. What we see of the external nature and what we experience of the external nature is only part of it. There is a hidden part to what is called the external nature itself. And this hidden part is what joins us to the universal nature. And that's what he's calling the occult aspect of the external nature.
Does that have any correlation with Carl Jung's collective unconscious, or perhaps the, in other terms, the shadow side of us?
I believe it is. Yeah, that's a good question. It's difficult to tell exactly what the correlation is. I don't think it's the collective unconscious, because what Jung calls the collective unconscious is actually more a kind of collective conscious, because, you know, that's the place where the archetypes reside and have an effect on our collective lives. But, it would correspond the collective unconscious would correspond to some of the ranges of cosmic mind that Sri Aurobindo is talking about. This is just my take on it. But if we want to translate into Jung's terminology, perhaps it is sort of like what you call the shadow, you know, the shadow that exists in the circumconscient, you know, the that in some sense connects us to the rest of the ignorance around us. And in fact, it increases in a sense if there is individual progress.
Vince, would you like to read next?
I just wanted to make a comment since this issue of the shadow was brought up. This is very interesting because there is correspondence about this very fact which Sri Aurobindo, somebody, one disciple, brought it to his notice. It was, I'm trying to remember his name, the person, Kishore Gandhi, who brought to Sri Aurobindo's notice this idea of the shadow that Hume talks about. And Sri Aurobindo, fully endorsed the idea, saying that, he's this is exactly very true. This is exactly what, one part of the problem is, and this idea of the shadow, something that is very, very pertinent to the yoga that he's talking about.
I'm not sure if my microphone is muted or not.
No, we can hear you just fine.
Oh, okay. A subjective spirituality can be established which refuses or minimizes commerce with the world or is content to witness its action and throw back or throw out its invading influences without allowing any reaction to them or admitting their intrusion. But if the inner spirituality is to be objectivized in a free world action, if the individual has to project himself into the world and in a sense take the world into himself, this cannot be dynamically done without receiving world influences through one's own circumconscient or environmental being. The spiritual inner consciousness has then to deal with these influences in such a way that, as soon as they approach or enter, they become either obliterated and without result or transformed by the very entry into its own mode and substance. Or it may force them to receive the spiritual influence in return with a transforming power on the world they come from. For such a compulsion on the lower universal nature is part of a perfect spiritual action. But for that, the circumconscient or environmental being must be so steeped in the spiritual light and spiritual substance that nothing can enter into it without undergoing this transformation. The invading external influences have not to bring in at all their lower awareness, their lower sight, their lower dynamism. But this is a difficult perfection because ordinarily the circumconscient is not wholly our own formed and realized self, but ourself plus the external world nature. It is, for this reason, always easier to spiritualize the inner self-sufficient parts than to transform the outer action. A perfection of introspective indwelling or subjective spirituality aloof from the world, a self-protected against it, is easier than a perfection of the whole nature in a dynamic, kinetic spirituality objectivized in the life, embracing the world, master of its environment, sovereign in its commerce with world nature. But since the integral transformation must embrace fully the dynamic being and take up into it the life of action and world self outside us, This completed change is demanded of the evolving nature.
So we see over here what he's talking about as a subjective spirituality is because of this very problem, what normally has been seen as the field of spiritual endeavor. For example, the monastic or the wandering sadhu, so to say, secludes himself or herself to some degree, moves only with others of their own kind, or even there, minimizes the contact with others so that this particular problem does not arise. Also, he's talking about this possibility of rejection of the forces of the outer world, building a kind of internal wall so that there is no response given. One minimizes one's relationship with the world and its forces, so to say. And this part is more like, there's a nice passage the mother is talking about, the power of rejection. You know, you remember that we are the user's formula, which is aspiration, rejection, and surrender in the book, The Mother. And she says that this power of rejecting whatever is intuited by discrimination to be against or harmful to the inner growth is something one has to do, so long as one is not powerful enough. But that rejection is not the end all, the end all of this process, and because of exactly what Sri Aurobindo is saying over here, which is that eventually there must be power over whatever kind of environing or world can come to us, and so along with the need to reject comes a complexity, which is the need to develop greater and greater power over the environing forces. And here Sri Aurobindo is talking about three different possibilities. As you say, he says, one is that as soon as they approach or enter, they become obliterated or without result. Okay, so it's an active consciousness. This is what an active consciousness can do, similar to what the mother said about active, and the example is given of how the storm cannot enter the room, even though it's creating havoc outside and the window is open, because the peace of the person is so solid that it just obliterates or just, repels the possibility of entering its aura. The second possibility is that it's transformed by its very entry into its own mode and substance. That is, this power, this force, whatever comes from the environment to the consciousness, the aura of this spiritual being, and in its entry gets transformed in its quality. Its truth, its whatever it the truth in it is retained. And whatever is gross or false in it is dissolved. That is the nature of the transformation and remains in that form. It gets automatically purified and transformed. And the third that he's talking about is that not only is it transformed, it is pushed back in a transformed form into the world. Or it may force them to receive the spiritual influence and return with the transforming power on the world they come from. And here he says that this indeed is, this is the desideratum. This is what ought to ultimately become the action of the yogin. Because he says, for that is, for such a compulsion of the lower universal nature is part of a perfect spiritual action. In other words, whatever it receives is what allows the transformation of the world. These are the kind of powers that the consciousness, the sort of yoga of power that Sri Ramananda was dealing with in Saptadushta, the siddhis of Ishita and Vashita, for example, have to do with Aishwarya, Ishita and Vashita. They have kinds of powers. At this moment, I don't remember exactly which one maps to which, but certainly one can presume, if one looks into it, that these are the three kinds of power, siddhis of power that need to be developed in reacting against the forces of the involved, the universal nature. One thing to remember is that Sri Aurobindo began his yoga as a yoga of power. He says, I began my yoga to gain power to liberate this colonized country. But, of course, it took on another turn altogether. You know, marks the yoga of Sri Aurobindo is this continuing need for power. The fact that it is the transformation of power, the yoga of power, to transform ultimately every possibility of, infection or invasion or ignorance of falsehood is what characterizes the achievement of the yoga of Sri Aurobindo. And I think this passage answers directly to that.
I somehow dropped off.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Your status was showing off. And,
yeah, I don't know what happened.
Okay.
I see that you've put down three books on the Christian way of inner transformation. That's very interesting, and I certainly would make a note of that, whoever wants to pursue that light of understanding.
Yeah, the second one, the celebration of discipline, when I thought about it later, I kind of think it relates a little bit to the concept of yoga, because it covers many different practices, all designed to affect transformation, from things like prayer and fasting to devotional readings and things. And I think that might correspond a little bit to the concept of yoga in some way.
Sure.
But Vince, those were the books that I was wanting last week. Those are the ones I wanted to look up for you.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you. I got the Aldous Huxley one. I've been reading that.
Oh, that's great. Okay.
Shall we read the next one?
Sure.
Yeah, Keka, would you like to read next? Are you there, Keka? Maybe Janet, can you go next? We'll wait.
Sure. Yeah, sure. Okay, hand. I have a little bit of a cold, so you'll have to excuse my voice. I think we're on, let's see, does it start with the essential difficulty?
Yes.
Okay.
Janet, you please go ahead, but I just had to connect my microphone.
That's
fine. I will read next. Okay, yeah, please go ahead. Okay. Thanks.
The essential difficulty comes from the fact that the substance of our normal being is molded out of the inconscious. Our ignorance is a growth of knowledge in the substance of being, which is nescient. The consciousness it develops, the knowledge it establishes, are always dogged, penetrated, enveloped by this nescience. It is this substance of nescience that has to be transformed into a substance of superconscience, a substance in which consciousness and a spiritual awareness are always there, even when they are not active, not expressed, not put into form of knowledge. Till that is done, the nescience invades or encompasses or even swallows up and absorbs into its oblivious darkness all that enters into it. It compels the descending light to compromise with the lesser light it enters. Here or there is a mixture, a diminution and dilution of itself, a diminution and a modification, an incomplete authenticity of its truth and power, or at the least, the nescience limits its truth and circumscribes its force, segments its applicability and its range. Its truth of principle is barred from a full truth of individual realization or from an achieved truth of cosmic practice. Thus, love as a law of life can affirm itself practically as an interactive principle, but unless it occupies the whole substance of being, the entire individual feeling and action cannot be molded by the law of love. Even if perfected in the individual, it can be rendered unilateral and ineffective by the general nescience, which is blind to it and hostile, or it is forced to circumscribe its range of cosmic application. A full action in harmony with the new law of the being is always difficult in human nature. For in the substance of the inconscience, there is a self-protective law of blind, imperative necessity, which limits the play of the possibilities that emerge from it or enter into it and prevents them from establishing their free action and result or realizing the intensity of their own absolute. A mixed, relative, curved, and diminished play is all that is conceded to them. Otherwise, they would cancel the frame of inconscience and violently perturb without effectively changing the basis of the world order. For none of them have in their mental or vital play the divine power to replace this dark original principle and organize a totally new world order.
So this is a really powerful paragraph in which Aurobindo is pointing out not merely the problem of the existence of the inconscious, but the wisdom of the existence of the inconscious, that it is actually a protective force, a protective necessity, as he points out. You know, this is what he calls in Savitri the dragon of the dark inconscient. You know, you know, so this force, our conscious power, is ultimately a, you know, sort of a condition, cosmic condition for our manifestation. And it belongs to the overmind. It's an overmental initiation, one would say. And nothing prior to the overmind or even belonging to the overmind can actually replace it with a new world order. This is the thing that he's pointing out, that even if this were to go, then there wouldn't be something that could take its place as the foundation, as a new foundation that is cosmic and harmonious. This maintains or conserves the law of cosmic creation, preservation, and destruction. If it's mutated, if it is abrogated, then there has to enter in its place some other cosmic harmonious principle of harmony. There must be something else that enters, and if it can't, then it creates only greater problem than what is achieved. Now, that said, he's also trying to talk about the fact that this is a problem which is cosmic, which he had introduced earlier, that we can go only so far in this process of transformation before it becomes a problem of changing the cosmic conditions itself. This is very forcefully brought up by him. And here he's talking about the fact, law of love that he's talking about is actually very reminiscent of the Christ. Particularly, in his life, as he says over here, even if perfected in the individual, it can be rendered unilateral and ineffective by the general nescience, which is blind to it and hostile, or it is forced to circumscribe its range of cosmic application. Again, we talked last time about the Buddha, and similarly being challenged at the end of the process of his own enlightenment by this dark foundation of death, of the nescience, as Aurobindo calls it, saying that it has the last claim on the earth. Okay. So he challenges it back, but his reverse challenge has to do more with escape from its power rather than replacement of its power. So this is what he's talking about, that we are better served to accept this law until and unless we have a law greater than that, which can replace the entire cosmic principle that holds things together, the dharma of the avidya. On the other hand, if we do accept it, then we will be subject to this limitation, that whatever we may achieve in the individual will be limited to only a small circle, or may be limited just to ourselves. It cannot become something that changes the entire working or functioning of the cosmic nature. And that world transformation is what he is after.
What you just talked about, Debashish, started to remind me of a passage in the Bible in the New Testament that talks about I can't remember the verse, but it's Jesus in the town that he grew up in trying to effect miracles, and he couldn't because of the people in the town who knew him growing up rejected his authority. And it seems to me, it's quite puzzling when you think about it, unless you realize that there is an acceptance that has to happen in the consciousnesses of other people to affect transformation.
Exactly. That's what he's saying over here, that acceptance, which we would think is almost impossible because, we live in a plural world. But the plural world is based exactly on this kind of ignorance. That's why he was saying But there must be something very basic to the cosmic condition that must change for that acceptance to occur. Can that acceptance occur without somebody being taught to accept it, without certain natural conditions in the upbringing bringing it about? So that is only possible if some particular principle of consciousness can transform the foundation of cosmic manifestation itself. This is why he's saying, I mean, he returns to this again and again, that whatever we may achieve, we fall short so long as we can't bring in this power that goes beyond the basis of cosmic manifestation, which is what he's calling the supramental. So the lid of the overmind, which is something that constrains the entire manifest cosmos, has to be in some way lifted, removed, so that a transformation of the very basis can take place. Individually, we can go up to a certain point, but we have to go beyond the individual into the cosmic consciousness and beyond the cosmic consciousness to bring that which has created the cosmic consciousness on us. That's what he's talking about in this.
Yeah, and it's interesting because it seems to me like a direct encounter with supramind, with an unprepared mind, would cause destruction in an unprepared consciousness because of the inability to assimilate.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes. So, Devashishtha, so in thoughts and aphorisms and in letters of yoga and in Savitri too, the paradigm of, you know, of hostile forces and divine forces and the forces of universal nature specifically preventing a person from quote-unquote crossing over, those paradigm come, right? Somehow it seems that paradigm of hostile forces and such is not explicitly brought out in the Life Divine. It seems that in these are paragraphs in which he might have been introducing that as some of the things that are facing the aspirant, so to say. Correct?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he doesn't use those terms. He doesn't use the hostile forces or. Well, of course, you know, there are chapters on the falsehood and the ignorance. You see, Sri Aurobindo does in the Life Divine, you know, we are only dealing with the second book, second part of the second book. But, you know, in the first part of the second book, you know, he does go quite detailed into the whole aspect of the difference between ignorance and falsehood. And Sri Aurobindo does give credence to the existence of falsehood. Beyond just ignorance, in this very way that we are talking about.
Okay, yeah, thank you, that was just that.
Shishita, can you please describe the Buddha's love towards humanity and what was the answer, why it wasn't the final? I know you described it, but I couldn't quite catch it. Can you please elaborate that part again?
So I was talking there about the Buddha's three realizations. And essentially those three realizations are very similar to this triple transformation idea, except that the third realization just enters into, you know, in a way it's like the ascent of Christ. Except in Christian mythos, it's achieved by the power of love. And in the Buddhist mythos, it is achieved by the power of meditation, you know. But essentially, the three transformations of the Buddha take him ultimately beyond the cosmos. But then he is faced exactly with this very power of the inconscient that challenges him, with regard to what holds the earth. It says to him that I am the final master of the earth. It's just like in Savitri, death says to Buddha, I am the master of the earth. And he says, no, you're not. I was here before you. And death says, who is there to witness that? And he touches the earth. He says, the earth was, he just touches the earth. And the earth trembles, giving assent saying that yes, he was here before you and death is vanquished. So there is a similar kind of idea, except that what I take it to be is that it's his escape from the law of death. He's saying that you have no hold on me because I have entered a realm of consciousness that is beyond your law. But it doesn't say that I am here to transform you and bring another law to all human beings. That's the reason why the love of the Buddha that you were asking about stands at the threshold of that transformation, calling every human being to achieve that. But that achievement would ultimately leave the earth as something that is bereft of any manifestation, because he's choosing to go beyond death by denying the manifestation.
Devashishta.
I had
a couple of questions. This chapter, these chapters that we're reading now and about to read from, say, Man and the Evolution, seem to really mesh in like really talk about his yoga and the changes. And also the last part of book one seems to. I'm just wondering, like, the philosophy of rebirth and the order of the worlds, I mean, I can see them in terms of Sri Aurobindo's philosophy, but I don't know, do they quite fit into the flow of the book?
I think they do, Vince, because there are four chapters there that philosophy of rebirth, is really covered through four chapters, which we did also, I mean, in our study.
Right.
And I believe he's setting up the whole process of evolution in terms of, I mean, firstly, he's explaining why this whole idea of rebirth, kind of how it fits into the process of evolution. I think that's where it's so important, because very fundamentally speaking, the question is that if it is really the anthropogenesis of the divine coming as every human being, ultimately evolving to the fullness of the divine personhood, then that must be achieved through a process that goes through these stages of life and death. And, these successions of life and death, just as he's talking here about the necessity, power of necessity of the darkened conscience, so too the necessity of the changes of robe, of garb that each life implies, is the condition for a cosmic nature, a universal nature to be assumed by the soul. The soul progresses from life to life. If it were indeed housed in a different kind of nature that was already, enlightened, that was already, free of the inconscience and ignorance, then this would not be necessary. But this idea of growth, it has to be mediated by, the power to challenge the existence of consciousness. That is what death represents. And therefore, the rebirth that expands the capacity of the soul over nature is how he sees the whole process of rebirth.
Well, thank you. That was a very good answer for me. The philosophy of rebirth and the order of the worlds was so packed with information, or I don't know if you call it information, whatever. It just seemed like he could have written books and books on those chapters.
Yeah, I agree. They're highly, very, very. And also because, there's a lot of occult information coming in over there, which he's reasoning out. He's using the intuitive reason to, you know, I mean, kind of give almost the logic of these occult processes, which is what makes it so dense, as you say.
Yeah. And my second question is, I've been just trying to understand more the place of good and evil in terms of the philosophy of Sri Aurobindo. I know it's kind of covered in book one. But I'm still kind of grappling with that. And I know it's somehow connected with monism and dualism, and, you know.
Yeah, but also in his case, it is connected with the evolution, because the whole idea is that if there is to be an evolution of consciousness arising out of a forgetting, a self-forgetting of God, if you want to call it that. That self-forgetting of God is basically the inconscient, the denial of or refusal of consciousness to itself, creating an original nescience, as he says, or inconscience. Now, the thing is that that condition, the creation of that condition, has to be given a certain independence of existence. If it is not given independence of existence, this is as the mother says, you know, one of the most interesting things about this manifestation is, you know, its freedom, that it embodies the freedom of God in a very special way. That and that freedom of God includes the freedom to choose against, you know, the growth of consciousness, to deny it, to refuse it. So both the refusal and the denial are forms of will. It's not just a form of absence. There's a difference between absence and the exercise of will. That exercise of will implies that there are powers that are, you know, kind of agents of choice. You see, those agents of choice, I mean, that's what the Christian tradition calls the fallen angels. And that is the very basis of falsehood. So if falsehood does not exist, that's again, it goes back to what we are studying actually right now, Vince, because this necessity that he talks about, this idea of a necessity at the very basis of existence, is the power of ignorance, which, you know, has something in it that wants to keep itself ignorant. Ultimately, that's the death that claims its original, power or dominance over this creation. See? That's again what we find in Savitri, where the debate of death brings out these points very clearly, how it exists to negate and deny the fullness of God, only because otherwise the evolution is not, does not manifest the freedom of God.
Well, thank you, Debashish. Yeah, that was a great explanation. One of the things I've struggled with for a long time, and I'm not even sure if I can properly articulate my questions, is this notion that consciousness is a whole ultimately. So we are all a part of a whole that encompasses everything, yet at the same time we are limited. It seems to be completely contradictory.
Exactly, it is contradictory, but it's an appearance. And that appearance is created so that it may be overcome in consciousness. In the individual, in the totality, in the cosmic mind, that contradiction does not exist. But in the evolving ignorance, that contradiction exists in every particle. And that's exactly what the whole purpose is. So that it's as if integrality is achieved in its fullness when the whole, the integral, is the realization of every part of the integral. But, you know, but as you said, if reality is a whole, that realization must be implicit to it. And that is the supramental condition. But the appearance of the absence of that condition is really just the condition of the play of evolution.
So is it a lack of awareness then of the supramental that is essentially the issue?
Yeah, it is, but it is almost as if that is the condition by which, as we discussed the fact that, you know, delight can be of many, God has already got fullness of delight because there is nothing absent in God.
Right.
But on the other hand, if there is to be a form of temporal knowledge, knowledge of growth, knowledge of loss and regaining, then this has to be undertaken in conditions where an appearance is created, where the parts of God seem to sort of fall out of the wholeness of God. See, so that appearance is the basis of our evolving ignorance.
Okay.
And that evolving ignorance must include within it, you know, the freedom to deny or keep the appearance, you know, as of absence in its place. And so it's only by straining against it, that's what gives the whole sense of struggle to our universe. And not only struggle in terms of what we experience as struggle in the spiritual life, but the very essence of struggle, the very essence of labor with which the whole world is packed, ultimately comes from that.
Okay. Thank you.
Devashish?
Yeah.
Doesn't the concept of the immanence of God as immanent and as cosmic and as transcendent work into that somehow? I mean, particularly, there's so much in Christianity about the transcendent God, but not the, I mean, heaven as being a place so far away that you aspire to, and it also leads to the, like looking down at people, this far off thought of a heaven as some place else you go to if you listen to right people. Doesn't that lead to, somehow that leads to a putting down of people that's,
yeah, that is true, Vince, but I don't think we can kind of limit any particular, say, for example, that kind of teaching exists in all religions as one particular interpretation, you may say. Unfortunate, but, you know, many religions are created out of some reward and punishment system, and that's a kind of a very narrow interpretation to the spiritual truth of any religion, I think. But it exists, you're right. And what you also said about the coexistence of the transcendent, the universal, and the immanent, and the ultimate, union of these three in realization is what we're talking about as the triple transformation. But exactly, that is so difficult to achieve, which is what he's going through over here. It is the fact, and yet, the experience of it in its fullness implies a tremendous yoga which ultimately ends up transforming the world.
Vince, are you a CPR student?
No, I'm not.
Okay. The first book on my list, number one, The Hearing God book, it addresses the part of your question in that.
Okay.
Dallas Willard explains Christianity in terms of a transcendent divine mind becoming in it through Jesus Christ. And because of the transcendent divine becoming immanent, that consciousness is still accessible on this plane of existence. That's his interpretation of the true role of Christian transformation, is that in aligning our quote, like, lesser, for lack of a better word, consciousness with the more perfected consciousness, that we will join in what they call the Christ consciousness and effect a change in the world through that. And it really parallels a lot of what I learned in UPR, in that consciousness is the primal element in the universe, and that it explained to me how, like, one consciousness could be still accessible, per se, and have a transforming effect on those around it. So anyway, it's a really good book, and it kind of addresses that transcendent versus immanent concept.
Well, thank you. I'd like to be able to better articulate both outwardly and within myself a lot of those ideas.
Yeah. It explains it. It's not the shallow version that is most known, you know, about.
I, as you're talking, I also have this, record of yoga part on the three siddhis of power that we were mentioning. What he's talking about over here, that those three powers of siddhis of power have all, in fact, to do with that third possibility that he opens up, that is transforming or having an effect on the forces that come to us from the outside. So maybe I'll read this part, from the scribal version of Sri Aurobindo's record of yoga. It says, first he's talking about receiving things from outside through communications of consciousness, but then here he's talking about having an effect on things by power of will of a higher consciousness. So in the same way, there is a power in the consciousness of acting upon other conscious beings or even upon things without physical means of persuasion or compulsion. Great men are said, and he's kind of looking at even the more natural or sort of ignorant operations of these sort of forces or these powers. Great men are said to make others do their will by a sort of magnetism. That is to say, there is a force in their words, in their action, or even in their silent will, or mere presence, which influences and compels others. To have these siddhis of power is to have the conscious and voluntary use of this force of chit. This is a particular force of chit, or pure consciousness, which ultimately motives these kinds of siddhis. The three powers are Aishwarya, Ishita, Vashita. These powers can only be entirely acquired or safely used when we have got rid of egoism and identified ourselves with the infinite will and the infinite consciousness. They are sometimes employed by mechanical means, example with the aid of mantras, tantric kriyas, etc. But he's talking about their direct operation through consciousness. And here is where he's describing the three. It says, Vashita is when you concentrate your will on a person or object so as to control it. Aishwarya is when you merely use the will without any concentration or control, and things happen or people act according to that will. Ishita is when you do not will, but merely have a want or need or a sense that something ought to be, and that thing comes to you or happens. So these are the operations of the powers of will, of the siddhis of will, in a way related to this transformative force on the external world that he's talking about.
Kekar, do you want to read next?
Yeah, sure.
Which would you please tell me the starting of paragraph?
This is the paragraph.
The transformation of human nature.
9-6.
A transformation of human nature can only be achieved when the substance of the being is so steeped in the spiritual principle that all its movements are a spontaneous dynamism and a harmonized process of the spirit. But even when the higher powers and their intensities enter into the substance of the inconscience, they are met by this blind opposing necessity and are subjected to this circumscribing and diminishing law of the nascent substance. It opposes them with its strong titles of an established and inexorable law. It's always the claim of life with the law of death, the demand of light when the need of a relief of shadow and a background of darkness. The sovereignty and freedom and dynamism of the spirit with its own force of adjustment by limitation, demarcation by incapacity, foundation of energy on the repose of an original inertia. There is an occult truth behind its negations which only the supermind with its reconciliation of contraries in the original reality can take up and so discover the pragmatic solution of the enigma. Only the supramental force can entirely overcome this difficulty of the fundamental nascence. For with it enters an opposite and luminous imperative necessity, which underlies all things and is the original and final self-determining truth force of the self-existent infinite. This greater luminous spiritual necessity and its sovereign imperative alone can displace or entirely penetrate, transform into itself, and so replace the blind anarchy of the inconscience. What does this anarchy mean?
I think it's a Greek god of necessity. Does anybody else have a thing on Ananke? I think a Greek god of necessity.
So that is the end of the paragraph.
The Ananti, according to Google, is the goddess of necessity, fate, or destiny.
Yeah, I'm seeing destiny and the mother of fate.
Yes, Greek mythology.
Yeah, so that's what it is. Power. Blind power of necessity, the unconscious.
more, so it sounds like law of inconscience.
Yes, the law of inconscience. Only that's why, as he pointed out, it's only another law that can replace it. It cannot just be negated, but replaced by another law. And that's why he says that only the supermind brings that other law, because it enters, with it enters an opposite and luminous imperative necessity, which underlies all things and is the original and final self-determining truth force of the self-existent infinite. That is the integrality of
Debashish, would you consider, and I know this, you can't really generalize mystical experiences, but would you say that a mystical experience is more an encounter with the overmind or the supermind?
Yeah, and it's difficult to tell. I mean, usually what we're talking about is a mystical experience may come from any particular realm of being, but it is usually an experience of the overmind. You know, it could also, it's definitely an experience of the overmind. One could have experiences of supermind or even beyond, Ananda consciousness, or what he calls the Satchidananda. But those kind of experiences are usually ones which we only have very dim recollection of. They are retained only in the sense of a vague sense of delight in trance. So that's why those three conditions, or four conditions of the Upanishads, you know, are talked about. That is, you know, when one enters into the subjective world, at its very peak are these, I believe, mystical experiences. So the sense of the oneness of the divine in a subjective consciousness. Beyond that is other potencies of the same, universality, but they are transcendent of the universe, and one usually falls into a trance which is so deep that one can't retain any sort of, you know, power of that experience. And so that is really what happens. So that, I mean, one does encounter, you know, the supermind or even beyond that in conditions of trance, but what is usually experienced as mystical experience is an encounter with the overmind, or that kind of a powers of the Satchidananda, even below the overmind. At any particular level, one can have a sort of a touch of the cosmic consciousness, and essentially it is overmental experience occurring at that level.
Okay, thank you.
I mean, the very word mystical means it's mystery, right? It's like it's not definable.
Yeah, there is always to it an edge of mystery that is not definable. I think that is very true, that the mystical encounter or the mystical experience merges into something which is indefinable, which is ineffable, as they say. And so there is a kind of sense of something beyond from which it is coming.
Yes, and there's a sense, there's certain knowledge that cannot be obtained, I think, in any way but through experiencing. You can't really describe the color blue as well as you can if you're looking at the color blue, for example, I think.
Yeah, I read that William James describes the experience of mysticism in four ways. And one is it's ineffable, and another is it's noetic, which he means it's, you gain knowledge by that experience. It's also transient. He says, and I think the fourth one is it's a passive experience.
I mean, as far as I understand this, knowledge, of course, it's a knowledge. It's not something obscure. but it's just that beyond the language of our the descriptions, it's yet to find the right language to express it. I mean, that's how I understand.
Yes, and it seems like the Hindu terms that I've studied in your classes, Debashish, that they have so many more words for the spiritual experiences of man than we do in the English language. Rather, like they say the Eskimos have, you know, 35 ways of describing snow when we only have one word for it, snow.
No, I too have been really impressed by all the Indian words for inner experiences. It's just so neat. I kind of feel, I mean, it hasn't been so developed in Western tradition. I think there's more, as William James would say, a secondhand knowledge. People are brought up to believe that they can read about those experiences that a certain person has had that's established religion. But you can't really have them yourself, in that if you do, you kind of looked at it as very strange for you. But it's not so at all. I know in the Eastern traditions, people can have experiences, and you know, it's fine.
We know, actually, when an expression goes, it has both ends, right? The person, I mean, or the thing that expresses and the thing that receives. So the receiver also has to sort of at least be in close contact of that layer of consciousness that is expressing. Or that is one way, and the other way that will be so strong that it can through the layer of the thing that is expressing. So it's somewhere in between, like, and you know, and because for me, is when I read Sri Aurobindo, I was very, very, you know, like overwhelmed that how things can be expressed in a language which was supposed to be inexpressible. That is not just the power of language, but the, you know, as we study in Veda, the words are like arrows. So it is the power that is coming behind that arrow. That is also one of the things. So basically, mystical is a generic term to cover all kinds of instances of this kind. But at the same time, if somebody doesn't have those words, doesn't mean that person or that thing didn't experience to that degree.
Sure. Also, I mean, as far as expression goes and knowledge goes, the knowledge of mystical experience carries a layer in it that is inexpressible. That's why it is ineffable, as they say. That expression, even in its highest power, hides depths within it that are not really in the word, but in some kind of transmission, of consciousness.
I remember a quote, I think it was either, perhaps it comes in Thoughts and Aphorisms, or it was by Swami Vivekananda, in which I think he says, a yogi experiences far more than he expresses.
It's Sri Aurobindo talking about Swami Vivekananda, actually, in the context of having, received guidance from him in Alipur jail, and somebody asked him a question about how Vivekananda could have shown him the way to the supermind when he never talks about it in his own writings. And that's the answer that Sri Aurobindo gives. He says a yogi experiences much more than he ever talks about or expresses.
So the other thing that I wanted to add to what Keka was saying about the receiver and the person who's expressing was that, I mean, I think that for many of us, or perhaps even most of us, we read these things and we have form some idea of what it may be, and then the actual experience of it many times is completely a different thing than the formulation that happens in the consciousness prior to the experience, correct?
Yeah, sure. It would depend really on, the degree of preparation. So always there will be something, exceeding whatever our expectations may be in an experience. But at the same time, the degree of preparedness or expectation depends on, the degree of expectation also depends on the degree of preparedness. That is, if we are, in a very superficial consciousness creating mental pictures of the supermind, even that is a step in that direction, and it may be very far from the truth, but essentially, as Krishna says, as you approach me, so I come to you. There is one must make one's best attempt, and that's the only way by which our aspiration becomes finer-tuned and new experiences prepare us so that that very expectation becomes more fine-tuned. It will never be exactly what the experience will be, but it will come closer and closer to it as the nature gets more conscious and prepared.
I think I remember reading a whole set of thoughts and aphorisms and the mother's writings in which in specifically they talk about this difference when it comes to divine love, that how different it is from what we associate as love, and how impersonal it can seem from some degree.
Sure, yeah.
Sitaram, do you want to read the next one?
A supramental change, that's the one, right?
Yeah, it's the last paragraph.
Supramental change of the whole substance of the being, and therefore necessarily of all its characters, powers, movements, takes place when the involved supermind in nature emerges to meet and join with the supramental life and power descending from supernature. The individual must be the instrument and first field of the transformation. But an isolated individual transformation is not enough and may not be wholly feasible. Even when achieved, the individual change will have a permanent and cosmic significance only if the individual becomes a center and a sign for the establishment of the supramental consciousness force as an overtly operative power in the terrestrial workings of nature. In the same way in which thinking mind has been established through human evolution as an overtly operative power in life and matter, this would mean the appearance in the evolution of agnostic being or purusha and agnostic prakriti, agnostic nature. There must be an emergent supramental consciousness force liberated and active within the terrestrial whole, and an organized supramental instrumentation of the spirit in life and the body. For the body, consciousness also must become sufficiently awake to be a fit instrument of the workings of the new supramental force and its new order. Till then, any intermediate change could only be partial or insecure. An overmind or intuitive instrumentation of nature could be developed, but it would be a luminous formation imposed on a fundamental and environmental conscience. A supramental principle and its cosmic operation, once established permanently on its own basis, the intervening powers of our mind and spiritual mind could found themselves securely upon it and reach their own perfection. They would become, in the earth existence, a hierarchy of states of consciousness rising out of mind and physical life to the supreme spiritual level. Mind and mental humanity would remain as one step in the spiritual evolution, but other degrees above it would be their form and accessible by which the embodied mental being, as it became ready, could climb into the process and change into an embodied, supramental and spiritual being. On this basis, the principle of a divine life in terrestrial nature could be manifested. Even the world of ignorance and inconscience might discover its own submerged secret and begin to realize in each lower degree its divine significance.
So this is how he completes this chapter, and you know, he points out how the individual really is the totality, is the integral being, and individual realization has to be one in which this fullness of its own reality is experienced. This is, individual must be the instrument and first field of the transformation. But an isolated individual transformation is not enough and may not be wholly feasible. This is exactly what he's pointing out with regard to the complications that arise when we are talking about the triple transformation. It is not fully even possible to achieve the triple transformation as an individual unless the individuality really becomes totally cosmic and transcendental. So he says, only if the individual change will have a permanent and cosmic significance, only if the individual becomes a center and a sign for the establishment of the supramental consciousness force as an overtly operative power in the terrestrial working of nature, the same way in which thinking mind has been established through the human evolution as an overtly operative power in life and matter. So this would imply that, that's again, we come back to what we were discussing earlier, one man's perfection yet may change the world, that ultimately the knowledge by even one person of its totality, of oneness with the transcendental principle, inclusive of the entire cosmic principle and the immanent principle, would allow for a new working in the world. Now, he takes that one stage further and says that this working would then not be only in the form of a consciousness, like a supramental consciousness, but be embodied in the instrumentality of the individual. That is the appearance in the evolution of a Gnostic being of Purusha and a Gnostic Prakriti, a Gnostic nature. So this is the sign of double working, the working of the descent of a new power, as well as the embodiment of that power through an instrumentality of Gnostic Purusha and Gnostic Prakriti. So this emergent supramental consciousness, liberated and active within the terrestrial whole, and an organized supramental instrumentation of the spirit in life and body. So even the body, that this is talking about the full transformation, and going to a point where it establishes its own workings in terrestrial nature. Now, if this occurs, he is talking about a complete change of what one might call the economy of the ignorance. And part of that change would be in the opening up of the new rungs of consciousness that intervene between the mental consciousness and the supramental consciousness. These would become available to the creation in a more open form. That is saying, a supramental principle and its cosmic operation, once established permanently on its own basis, the intervening powers of overmind and spiritual mind could found themselves securely upon it and reach their own perfection. They would become in the earth existence a hierarchy of states of consciousness, rising out of mind and physical life to the supreme spiritual level. So these rungs would then exist, as it were, and it would be possible for consciousness to traverse this ladder of the higher sort of ranges of mental and supramental consciousness. this ability to climb, as he says, into the gnosis and change into an embodied spiritual and supramental being, that would bring about the condition for a new kind of life on earth, which is what he's calling the life divine. And so essentially he is coming, one may say, towards close to the end of his thesis, which is what the whole book is about, the life divine. What are the conditions for the life divine, and what is its necessity? That is where he's coming up to this point. There are a couple of passages in Savitri that talk about this encounter with the dark inconscient that he's talked about over here, which is the foundation, one may say, of the cosmic ignorance. And maybe we can end with the reading of one of those passages.
Sure, we can do that.
It's interesting that, just to add a little thing, that in the book, Life Divine, it's exactly, we are at the end of 1,000 pages. So I just thought of mentioning, since you all are looking at the PDF, so.
That's interesting.
So there was the what canto were you referring to?
Okay, here I'm looking at there's an even more strong one, but this one is book 2, canto 8, the world of falsehood, the mother of evil, and the sons of darkness. And I'm looking towards the end. I'm reading from, I don't know, this version is a little earlier, page 229 in this version. And this is Ashwapati's farther down into this particular foundation of the ignorance. all things were conscious there and all perverse. In this infernal realm he dared to press, even into its deepest pit and darkest core, perturbed its tenebrous base, dared to contest its ancient privileged right and absolute force. In night he plunged to know her dreadful heart. In hell he sought the root and cause of hell. Its anguished gulfs opened in his own breast. He listened to clamors of its crowded pain, the heartbeats of its fatal loneliness. Above was a chill, deaf eternity. In vague, tremendous passages of doom, he heard the goblin voices that guides to slay and face the enchantments of the demon sign and traverse the ambush of the opponent snake. In menacing tracks, in tortured solitudes, companionless he roamed through desolate ways where the red wolf waits for the fordless stream and death's black eagles scream to the precipice, and met the hounds of Baal who hunt men's hearts, baying across the belts of destiny. In footless battlefields of the abyss, fought shadowy combats in mute eyeless depths, assaults of hell endured and titans fought, and bore the fierce inner wounds that are slow to heal. A prisoner of a hooded magic force, captured and trailed in falsehood's lethal net, and often strangled in the noose of grief, or cast on the dim morass of swallowing doubt, or shut into pits of error and despair, he drank her poisoned draughts till none was left. In a world where neither hope nor joy could come, the ordeal he suffered of evil's absolute reign, yet kept intact his spirit's radiant truth. Incapable of motion or of force, in matter's blank denial jailed and blind, pinned to the black inertia of our base, he treasured between his hands his flickering soul. His being ventured into mindless void, intolerant gulfs that knew not thought nor sense. Thought ceased, sense failed, his soul still saw and knew. In atomic parcelings of the infinite, near to the dumb beginnings of lost self, he felt the curious small futility of the creation of material things. Or stifled in the inconscient's hollow dust, he sounded the mystery dark and bottomless of the enormous and unmeaning deeps, whence struggling life in a dead universe rose. There in the stark identity lost by mind, he felt the sealed sense of the insensible world, and a mute wisdom in the unknowing night. Into the abysmal secrecy he came, where darkness peers from her mattress gray and nude, and stood on the last locked subconscious floor, where being slept unconscious of its thoughts and built the world, not knowing what it built. There, waiting its hour, the future lay unknown. There is the record of the vanished stars. There in the slumber of the cosmic will, he saw the secret key of nature's change. A light was with him, an invisible hand was laid upon the error and the pain, till it became a quivering ecstasy, the shock of sweetness of an arm's embrace. He saw in night the eternal shadowy veil, knew death for a seller of the house of life, in destruction felt creation's hasty pace, knew loss as the price of celestial gain, and hell as a shortcut to heaven's gates. Then, in illusion's occult factory, and in the inconscient's magic printing house, torn were the formats of the primal night, and shattered the stereotypes of ignorance. Alive, Breathing a deep spiritual breath, nature expunged her stiff mechanical code and the articles of the bound soul's contract. Falsehood gave back to truth her tortured shape. Annulled were the tables of the law of pain, and in their place grew luminous characters. The skillful penman's unseen finger wrote his swift, intuitive calligraphy. Earth's forms were made his divine documents. The wisdom embodied mind could not reveal in conscience chased from the world's voiceless breast. Transfigured were the fixed schemes of reasoning thought. Arousing consciousness in things inert, he imposed upon dark atom and dumb mass the diamond script of the imperishable. Inscribed on the dim heart of fallen things, a paean song of the free infinite, and the name, foundation of eternity, and traced on the awake exultant cells, in the ideographs of the ineffable, the lyric of the love that waits through time, and the mystic volume of the book of bliss, and the message of the superconscient fire. Then life beat pure in the corporeal frame. The infernal gleam died and could slay no more. Hell split across its huge abrupt facade as if a magic building were undone. Night opened and vanished like a gulf of dream. Into being's gap scooped out as empty space in which she filled the place of absent God. There poured a wide, intimate, and blissful dawn. Healed were all things that time's torn heart had made, and sorrow could live no more in nature's breast. Division ceased to be, for God was there. The soul lit the conscious body with its ray. Matter and spirit mingled and were one.
The terribleness really comes alive in these pages. So it seems logical that we stop here and continue with the next chapter the coming Thursday.
Sure.
And we can stop with a brief meditation just now.
Sure.